Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures. For more than 50 years, the museum has told stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character. Details at texancultures.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me in the studio to try to make sense out of what happened with the Super Tuesday primaries is San Antonio Express News columnist Gilbert Garcia. We're going to be looking at local, regional, state, and national implications of the results. But first, how did the process go?
Right. I think we saw in Bexar County, but I think in other big counties in the state, we saw long lines. We saw people still trying to vote after voting had ended at 7 o'clock. I think we often praise the elections office in Bexar County. I think that they work really hard and they do a really fair job. But it was a very slow process Tuesday night getting the results. They also had they had some problems with the voting machines in some instances early in the day. We had they've changed the process by which they report the results, and which I think is a lot less user friendly. I think those who were trying to follow on Tuesday night were very frustrated, because in the past we've gotten kind of combined early voting totals, and then we mixed in with the election night results as they start to come in. In this case, you had early voting on one page, you had election night on another page, you had absentee votes on a third, and you had to kind of put them together yourself and try to figure out what was going on. And it was a long night for a lot of people.
So we're trying to understand is, did something go wrong at all? The fact that it takes all night to tabulate the election results, is that actually a problem? Is this something that can, if it is a problem, can it be fixed? Or is it us where we're just spoiled expecting to have instantaneous results?
I think there's something to that. I think that you were going to have a big turnout. You had a very long ballot. I think it was completely surprising that things were going to move a little bit slowly. And the elections office did want to hold back in releasing early voting, putting it on their website. To release those results while people are still in the process of voting on election day. So that's understandable. I think that, there's some anecdotal accounts of just polling sites where maybe you didn't have enough election workers or...
One polling site didn't have any power.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, there are things like that. And problems will come up. But you would want to create a system where you anticipate, and this isn't just a Bexar County problem, but it's a statewide problem. And I think that I think there are problems in California and other places, but you don't want people to have to wait in line for 3-4 hours.
These are separate things. Okay, like, are there enough polling sites? Are they fully staffed? I heard about some election workers not showing up because they were worried about coronavirus. We had a shortage of those workers. But number one, typically this is the way it used to work. And I don't know if it's now part of the days gone by, talking around the old Cracker Barrel about how great things used to be. But at 7 o'clock, mm-hmm. Within minutes, 2 or 3 minutes after 7 o'clock, those early voting returns would be right there in front of on your computer monitor. And you'd be able to have a really good sense of how the night was going to go.
That's right.
Now we're hearing that, they don't tabulate those numbers in advance. They let them sink, sit in the computer and marinate, because they don't want these numbers to be pre-tabulated and then leaked out in advance. Mm-hmm. So no one knows, not even Jackie Callahan, what the number is going to look like until they hit the button and it spits out and it goes on the computer. Now, last night, they hit the button and it was clunkety, 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 clunkety. The little gerbil in there was working really hard, but it took a long time to spit out those numbers. And then simultaneously, we were hearing about all these long lines. We've had people standing in line before to vote in elections, and they would release these early voting numbers without, any sort of regard for those. So did that change?
It's a good question. And I really don't know the answer to that. But I think there was some caution about putting the numbers out. I think that was probably what accounted for the delay. But I know that, I was hearing from a lot of people, including elected officials, just wondering what's going on.
Oh, yeah. Everyone's like online going, is it just me? Why can't I get these numbers? Yeah. I'm looking for the little link and it's not there. But so here in Bexar County, people voted maybe 1-2 hours after poll closing. In Harris County, there were people voting 5 hours.
Yeah. And it's I mean, the most positive spin I guess you could put on it is just that it's really admirable that people hung in there and were determined to vote. But you know, you really hate for things for people to be to put through that long away. People shouldn't have to.
Right, and wonder, well, this next time it's time to go vote, will they be reluctant to stand in lines like another 5 hours? You know, before I was committed, I didn't want to give up. They had the sunk cost bias. I'm already here, but next time, maybe not so much.
In an age when we hear so much about voter apathy, and it really, I think, depends on the elections. We've seen, you know, in the 2018 midterms, we saw a great turnout in Texas and around the country. So I think it depends on the elections. But we hear so much about voters not being engaged enough, and it just seems that we should do everything to create a system where it's as fast and as easy for people as possible.
Still, I want to know, I mean, what went wrong? I mean, if someone can tell me, like, these are the things that went wrong. We didn't have enough polling places, or we didn't anticipate there was going to be this much participation. Is this the way it's going to have to be in the future, where the polling places, where we had enough of them, but they were in the wrong places? What kind of accountability is done afterwards to figure all this out?
Yeah, there are going to be some questions about it. And like I said, it's these questions will be statewide. I think we have to do better going forward.
And some people do allege that, you know, the fact that they make voting harder in Texas is a voter suppression tactic. You know, long lines, it's acceptable to a point, but when it becomes this bad, it is bluntly a blunder and needs to be corrected. Do we need more money? Are we funding these things correctly?
Yeah, I think we do. Absolutely. I think we need more resources behind it.
And we'd be interested to see what some of these Texas election protection monitor hotlines that were promoted. Mm-hmm. I know Common Cause put one out. And we'll be getting a report from them about what they heard from their constituents. But we did have the election. I don't think it really matters that reporters didn't get the numbers. The numbers weren't as hot and fresh as the pizza that they have in the
newsroom. Well, I think the frustrating thing is that just regular voters in the community were also feeling that same frustration and wondering what's going on.
Yeah. Right. But, you know, hopefully when you wake up, and there's you have the information right in front of you, and it is correct and accurate, yeah. And we have a pretty good idea. But still, even right now, there's some question marks about how these races are going to fall. So looking at some of the important Bexar County races, where are some real chin strokers about what is going on here? And the race for sheriff, it's probably the only race that actually involved the entire county. And so it was really interesting to see how that was going on with two different primaries.
Well, I think one of the stories from Bexar County from Tuesday night is that it was a really good night to be a Rickoff. You had Jerry Rickoff, the former county clerk, running for sheriff in the Republican primary. He's going to be facing the Democratic Sheriff Javier Salazar in November. And you also had Tom Rickoff, the former probate court judge, and which I think yeah. was I
Let's
think
do one Rickoff at a time.
Okay.
Okay, because people already got these guys. You know, they don't know who they're voting for. Right. Jerry and Tom and Jerry.
They won a lot of elections, and they served in Bexar County for a long time.
They don't know who they're voting for, so right. It's kind of a confusion. It's kind of like maybe the Republican version of the Castro brothers sometimes.
Yeah.
But even though they're not twins, so it's interesting though. In the Republican primary for Bexar County Sheriff, that former Bexar County clerk, Jerry Rickoff, who has no law enforcement experience, managed to finish as the top guy and without going into a runoff in the field, running for sheriff. And he's running against two others, Willie Ng, who was a former criminal investigator for the district attorney's office. You know, he had law enforcement experience, and also the other candidate.
I think Willie was somebody that was, you know, you saw a lot of his campaign signs around. He seemed to have a lot of support. He's somebody who was very close to former district attorney Nico LaHood. As you said, he had law enforcement experience. I think there were many people in the local Republican Party thought that this is somebody who has a really good chance.
And Gary Garcia, who was the third candidate and that also had law enforcement experience, and he also was overlooked in favor of Jerry Rickoff. You have to wonder, like, is this because if you run with a good German name in a Republican primary in Bexar County, that you're going to have an advantage?
Well, you know, the Rickoff name had really been sort of gold in Republican politics in Bexar County for a long time, until recently, you know. And that's, I think that came into play. And as you said, I mean, if you're looking at somebody who has law enforcement experience, it wasn't the obvious move for Republican voters, but I think that the name recognition played a big part. And getting to the other Rickoff, Tom Rickoff, who was running for county commissioner, and he was running in the Republican primary, which for the what is really the only Republican seat on the commissioner's court, the seat that Kevin Wolf is vacating. And, you know, Tom Rickoff had been a probate court judge in recent years. There had been a lot of controversy about him and just his absenteeism on the court. He ran against Nelson Wolf for county judge a couple of years ago, and it was a pretty dismal campaign. And it was starting to kind of it looked like he was kind of ending his career as this kind of like fringe figure, kind of throwing out a lot of conspiracy theories about the county government. And here he finds himself in a runoff with Trish DeBerry, who's the consultant who, you know, has all the business support, has, you know, raised a lot of money.
He's very close to Judge Wolf.
Yeah, and that's right. So I think that I think the way things shape up, I mean, she's somebody who's would probably be more of a bipartisan figure, would be able to work with Judge Wolf, and he would come in there and kind of want to blow things up. I mean, he's somebody who's attacked both of the Wolves quite a bit, and just said that there's corruption and all kinds of,
he has this very big diagram. Have you seen this diagram that he's drawn? Mm-hmm. About all these lines going in circles and connecting the dots and about how all the corruption works downtown and in the center of it is Nelson Wolf.
And, you know, in I will say,
I call this, there's this, it's a I just want to say it's a conspiracy,
right,
kind of a thing. There's nothing, there's no true allegation with any fact that there's anything wrong with the way things
he are. Tends to put things together. If somebody was seen with somebody in the they were on the same floor of the same building on a certain day, and then a vote was taken, you know, it's to me, it's some of it is in that kind of territory. I will say, though, that, you know, there are, I think, legitimate complaints that have been made about county government, because, I mean, there are no, as an arm of the state, there are no fundraising limits. There's a lot less transparency in county government. And I think he's been able to take advantage of that to some degree. But I also think that the Rickoff name kind of carried him.
Let's go back to what we're saying with Jerry Rickoff, to talk about what he says he brings to the table, even mm-hmm. though he has no law enforcement experience. He says he does have administration experience, and that's what he says is the failing for the incumbent and now the renominated Sheriff Javier Salazar.
Right.
So he says, he is an administrator, and we've seen problems at the Bexar County Jail, you know, with Javier Salazar. Now he vanquished his challengers. He's renominated, but we saw, you know, a lot of problems with jail deputies and detention guards being arrested frequently, you know, not uncommonly.
Prisoners being released by mistake and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Right. So those types of issues.
Yeah. And I mean, there's some truth to the fact that it is essentially an administrative position, and he does have that kind of experience. And I think the climate is going to be good in Bexar County for the Democratic Party in November. I think if we look at past history and sort of the way things are going in 2020, but the sheriff, though he is a Democrat, and I think the political climate will be good for him in that sense. I think he's going to have a tough race because of the issues that you mentioned, and these have been in the news a lot. And I think he has made an effort to deal with them and talk about them openly, but they've still added up, and they're going to be a big problem for him.
All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to continue our conversation talking about the election results from Super Tuesday. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me in the studio is Gilbert Garcia from the Express News, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're recapping Super Tuesday results. What did we come up with? What did we end up with these two primaries, the Republican, the Democratic primary here locally? With me in the studio, Gilbert Garcia, San Antonio Express News city columnist. One of the big local races that was captured the nation's attention was the race between Representative Henry Cuellar and Jessica Cisneros, who was an immigration attorney who had challenged him for the Democratic nomination. And whoever basically wins that nomination is pretty solid going to win the office. Henry Cuellar won that 2 years ago with 85% of the vote.
Right.
So what was the big issue with that race?
Now, you had Henry Cuellar, who has been seen by many Democrats over the years as kind of one of the Republicans' favorite Democrats. I mean, Jessica Cisneros actually called him Donald Trump's favorite Democrat. I mean, people will remember back in the early days of his tenure in Congress, George W. Bush, who was then president, when he was on his way down the aisle to make his State of the Union address, kind of grabbing Henry Cuellar's cheeks, there was this great affection that he had for him. He was appointed Secretary of State in Texas many years ago, nearly 20 years ago, by Rick Perry, at the time when Rick Perry was about to become the governor of Texas, a Republican governor. So he's always worked with Republicans a lot. He's worked with John Cornyn, on the Republican U.S. Senator, on immigration issues. And I think a lot of Democrats thought, this is a Democratic district. We could have, this isn't a swing district where we have to kind of try to win over independents and Republican voters to get someone in that seat, like U.S. District 23, for example. In this district, we could have what they view as a true Democrat, and he's somebody who has been resistant to reproductive rights. He's been sort of pro-gun. He did vote for the Affordable Care Act, which was, you know, one of the big votes where he did in his time in Congress, where he did line up with his fellow Democrats.
But he did vote for the articles of impeachment.
But he's in many cases he has gone against his party. He's defined himself as a centrist who is an independent thinker. But, a lot of Democrats in South Texas, I think, had been frustrated with him for many years. And Jessica Cisneros is somebody who's 26 years old. She was sort of sponsored by the Justice Democrats, a progressive organization that also helped Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez pull off a major upset in New York against a Democratic incumbent. So there was the thinking among some progressives was that we could be seeing a repeat here. Now, the climate is very different in South Texas. I mean, I think one of the challenges that people mentioned to me that she had is, certainly people, there were many people who were sort of tired of Henry Cuellar and in that position and admired her, her energy and her passion. I think one of the challenges she had is that, for example, like Bernie Sanders and other progressives, she was in favor of an all-out fracking ban.
And this is Eagle Ford Shale territory.
Yeah. And so we're in South Texas where there were people who, I think voters who I heard about who said, well, you know, we understand the environmental issues, but people are worried about their jobs being affected. So, at the same time, if she had compromised on issues like that, then I think she wouldn't have had the support she did. And she certainly was able to sort of galvanize progressives. The Cuellar camp sort of tried to suggest that, she's really not from the district. All this support and money is coming from outside because she got Bernie Sanders' support, Elizabeth Warren. Julian Castro actually also got behind her in the last couple of weeks. But she ran an amazing race. She got more than 48% of the vote, and to challenge a really powerful congressman this is somebody who's represented Laredo for more than 30 years. His brother is the sheriff of Webb County. His sister is the Webb County tax assessor collector. They were all on the ballot at the same time. This family is very powerful in Laredo, which is where most of the votes are, or nearly half the votes. And she almost won this race.
I mean, I've known Henry Cuellar for many, many years.
Right.
Back to the days when I was a reporter in Laredo, and he was a state representative, and we could always go to him for some sort of news about what was happening. This is who he is. When he represents Laredo, he's representing basically his own point of view.
Right.
And it was interesting that Jessica Cisneros was able to say, let's challenge him, which was unheard of. No one could think who could challenge Henry Cuellar. There's been a target on his back for quite a while. We could really put a true progressive in this area, because it's an area that has a lot of needs. When he votes against things like food stamps and affordable housing and all these other types of issues, it seems like he's hurting his constituency, but you know, really he's representing the banks in Laredo and a trade in Laredo. He's also very involved in negotiating with Mexico and Central America.
He's very pro-NAFTA and the NAFTA reboot that recently
passed. So he's very interested in trade and making Laredo work and deal with that. So and he was also very much against things like Dodd-Frank and stuff that hurt the banks. My big question, though, I saw that Nancy Pelosi, Speaker Pelosi, came down to Laredo and basically campaigned for him, raised money for him, spoke vocally for him. And you have to kind of wonder, like, what is up with Nancy Pelosi? This is Cuellar has got to have been a thorn in her side, because he was not always, she really couldn't count on him to vote on these votes where they really wanted to have party unity, and not give the talking point of some sort of bipartisanness. Like if they lose one vote on impeachment, then they give Fox News to say, well, some Democrats don't support impeachment. And he was one of the last Democrats to come on board to vote for these types of things. So Nancy Pelosi comes down to Laredo for the Washington's birthday celebration, which is a big to-do down there. Mm-hmm. And she puts her arms around him and says, I don't just want him to win, I want him to win big. And you have to wonder, what is the calculus that's going through her head? And that so she would rather have a thorn in her right side called Henry Cuellar than a bigger thorn in her left side, which would be called another Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
I mean, I think that's the way I see it, too. I mean, I don't know what the personal relationship is between the two of them. But I think there were many progressives in the Democratic Party who were very upset about the fact that she got involved in that way. When, as I said, you know, this is someone who if you wanted somebody who was going to be consistently with the Democrats, I think you don't have to worry about winning the general election. You could have in that district somebody who is more consistently voting with Democrats. But, you know, the argument that he's made and his supporters have made over the years is that while it's a very Democratic district, that it's not necessarily the most progressive district, and you've lived there. But I mean, I think that the argument is made that it's obviously a very Latino district, but the argument has been made that it's more kind of moderate than maybe some other parts of the state.
Well, that remains to be seen in today's results, you know, sort of put that in question.
Absolutely.
The question now is, like, will Cuellar now be playing, does he owe Nancy Pelosi anything? Mm-hmm. Will he sort of like come back a little more towards her point of view on thinking about things?
Yeah.
Or, I mean, I can't imagine him changing at all, because I've known this guy for a long time and this is who he actually is. I mean, Jessica Cisneros is very young. What is she, 26? 26 years old. It's only
barely out of law school,
2 years away. There's going to be another election for this seat. And she could spend the next 2 years saying, I'm the person that almost took down Henry Cuellar, continue to build her name recognition, to build, and she's learned a lot in this race, and come back.
I think she's gonna have a tremendous future. And I could see her confidence growing as she went along, because I mean, this is, you know, you're getting thrown into the deep end of the pool when you're 26 years old and you're running for Congress, especially against a really powerful incumbent.
Yeah. And there's already like elementary school named for Henry Cuellar in Laredo. Okay. So, I mean, you really have a hard time beating the power of incumbency in that sort of circumstance. Is very tough.
One thing I want to mention, I think is really interesting. If you kind of, for those of us who kind of like start look at some of the, the numbers and kind of digging down deep into some of these things. One of the things, I will probably talk a little bit more about the presidential race, but as we go along, but one thing that was very interesting is that, you know, Jessica Cisneros is obviously in kind of the Bernie Sanders progressive Democratic camp.
A Green New Deal type.
Exactly. And Medicare for All. And she and Bernie Sanders had similar results in Bexar County. Now, Bexar County is basically about 15% of the vote in District 28. It's like maybe the east side of San Antonio is part of that district. So it's not a huge part of the district. But within Bexar County, both Bernie Sanders beat Joe Biden by nearly 2-1 in early voting. And Jessica Cisneros did, but similar had similar results with Henry Cuellar. But on election day, with Joe Biden picking up momentum in the presidential race, Joe Biden actually beat Bernie Sanders in Bexar County on election day. But Jessica Cisneros was able to continue what she did in early voting and win Bexar County on election day by a huge margin. So my point being that she outperformed Bernie Sanders by a great margin on election day. And I mean, I was approaching this thinking that her success would be to some degree tied to Bernie Sanders, that his coattails would be really critical for her, but she really outperformed in our local community on election day.
Right. But so in this 28th congressional district, during redistricting, which will be happening in about 2 years, this has one more election in this current map. If Cuellar hangs on to that district, you can bet San Antonio is going to be cut out of that district. He's going to find a way to make it more of a border-sided district.
That's right. Because, I mean, the margin was a couple of thousand votes in his favor in winning the race, and Bexar County almost cost him that. If Bexar County had been a bigger part of that district, he wouldn't have survived.
Yeah, you can see how the district is drawn now. There are more voters in the San Antonio part of the map than in the Laredo part of the map, which is a strong point. But in Laredo, the primary is a bigger deal there. So you're going to have a stronger turnout in Laredo. So it's weighted in for him to succeed.
You have a little bit of Hidalgo County in there too, which, and I'm not,
Zapata,
I haven't taken a close look at
Star County, yeah, right. All those areas, but you know, he's good in those areas. But so we'll see what happens to Jessica Cisneros. I'm sure we have not heard the last of her. Kind of like what we saw what happened with Precinct 2 here in Bexar County with Commissioner Justin Rodriguez seeking to get the renomination, and because he was appointed. This was his first run for
that race.
But this was not the first run for the other big name in that race, Geta Rodriguez.
Yeah, and that was, you know, you have some races like this, unlike the Cisneros Cuellar race, which was very ideological, a centrist versus a progressive. In this case, you're really dealing more with just, you know, personal preference between two Democratic candidates. You had Justin Rodriguez, who people will remember as a former state representative and a former city council member.
And SAISD.
Yeah. And Geta Rodriguez, who, you know, is a military veteran and had run the county Veterans Administration office.
She has a family involved in politics.
Yeah. Her mother, Lourdes Galvan, was a council member, and her father has been an activist over the years. So, you know, she... you could kind of compare what she did 2 years ago to what Jessica Cisneros did in District 28, in the sense that she took on a really powerful, entrenched political figure, Paul Elizondo, who has since passed away. But she took him on and it ran a very close race. And so she was trying to build on that and come back. She wanted the appointment when Paul Elizondo passed away a few months after she lost that primary and was not really considered. I think Justin Rodriguez was the kind of the automatic choice of Judge Wolf.
The fact that you think that you deserve an appointment makes me wonder because, Justin Rodriguez, I mean, city council, state rep, mm-hmm. SAISD board member. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's kind of like covered all the bases. He mm-hmm. understands local government and, right. and he can keep the seat and get that just because you're able to challenge Paul Elizondo and do pretty well doesn't mean that you're entitled to an appointment.
Yeah, I think her argument was probably more that she should have been considered or there should have been. But, you know, that's how these appointment processes
tend to work.
What
does that mean? Be considered? Okay, I don't know what that means.
Well, I'll put it this way. If you look at this.
Take you out to lunch, buy a cup of coffee.
Well, if you look at, the city, I'm just saying if you compare when the city council has a vacancy, they have a process by which they interview various candidates, then they whittle it down to finalists, they bring them back in to, you know, so they can, then they listen to them. They probably have, in many cases, a finalist or a preferred candidate in mind from the beginning, but they do have a process. So, I mean, you could argue that should exist at the county level, but it didn't really happen in this case.
So instead we have elections. And so now we have Justin Rodriguez is going to be the nominee for Precinct 2, which is a traditionally a very Democrat district. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see how that moves forward in right. the general election. But one of our precincts, one of our districts for the county commissioners is unsettled, and that's with Precinct 1. Which That's is right. Generally something that we really don't spend enough time or energy or focus on understanding. That was where Sergio Chico Rodriguez, he is now the incumbent. He has been serving that on the commissioner's court, and he has he's going to be in a runoff against Rebecca Clay Flores, and so that May runoff could be very interesting because it is a huge precinct. It is almost like half of the county.
Yeah, and you know he's. He's been part of a major Southside political family. His brother Sir Rodriguez, served in Congress.
And he's a justice of the peace now.
He's justice of the peace now. Chico Rodriguez's niece, Xochitl Peña Rodriguez, is now in a runoff for the state Senate. So the Rodriguez family has been a major force in local politics, but there are people I think who have legitimately questioned, you know, what he's done in his long time on the commissioner's court. He doesn't really have too much to show for his tenure there, and I think that was a case. You know, I don't think we necessarily had
but we haven't really been looking at it close enough. We don't know
that's
what
right.
what he's doing.
Yeah,
I mean, we should know, but unfortunately, there's a lot going on.
Well, I think when he the Express News editorial board brought the candidates into who were seeking the endorsement. The question was put to him, pretty plainly, like, what are you most proud of in your time on commissioner's court? And we're basically talking about 2 decades that he's been. And he pointed to a couple of things that really were not necessarily things that he had done, but that the court had done. And so, I think that it's a legitimate question. It's one that he's going to have to answer. I mean, because I don't think we necessarily saw a big anti-incumbency wave in the Democratic Party in this primary, but I think we saw individual races where there were candidates, whether it was Henry Cuellar in District 28 or Chico Rodriguez in this county commissioner race, where people were looking and questioning their record, and I think they were vulnerable for that reason.
Yeah, and so it would be interesting to hear from Rebecca Clay Flores and from Sergio Chico Rodriguez. We'll be extending an invitation to them to come on The Source and to talk about what they see as the needs for Precinct 1 and asking for votes in that runoff. And hopefully we'll have a good turnout for that. We're going to take another break, and we'll continue the conversation as we talk about what happened on Super Tuesday, on what happened on Wednesday. And I'm talking with Gilbert Garcia, the Express News columnist, and I'm David Martin Davies. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast comes from Sunshine Cottage's Noche del Sol, a fiesta kickoff event with Mexican food, entertainment, and Delaritas, plus a raffle and auctions to benefit the School for Deaf Children, March 26th, 6 p.m. More at sunshinecottage.org.
Welcome back to Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Super Tuesday is over. It's What Happened Wednesday. And with me in the studio, Gilbert Garcia from the San Antonio Express News. The big race for the 23rd Congressional District, which is stretches all across West Texas along the border, which was Will Hurd's seat, the Republican, mm-hmm. that is shaping up to be one to watch.
Yeah, and the recent history in District 23, at least since the district lines were redrawn by court order about 14, 15 years ago, the history of that has basically been that in presidential election years, it goes when you have a big turnout, it goes Democratic. In midterm elections, it goes Republican. Will Hurd defied that to some degree because he was able to win 3 elections in a row, whereas previously, it had been going back and forth.
It had been the swingingest district
in Texas, absolutely. The one, some would say, the one true swing district in the state, at least in recent years. So what we're looking at there is like Will Hurd decided to step down. I think people might say that he was looking at the political realities. He won an incredibly close election against Gina Ortiz Jones, the Democratic nominee, 2 years ago. And it was clear that she was going to challenge him again. And in 2020, it was going to be difficult. So he decided to step down. So Gina Ortiz Jones is running again. She coasted to the Democratic nomination.
Crushed it.
Yeah, and really, I think has been running kind of a general election campaign since she got in the race. You know, a couple of years ago, she, for example, I think talked about Medicare for All. She's kind of during this campaign has talked more about, you know, a public option and enhancing the Affordable Care Act. It's, you know, it's a district where you have to really kind of almost take a bipartisan tone to be successful. The Democrats that have won there, you know, Pete Gallego, most recently, were, you know, kind of moderate and kind of willing to work across the aisle. So she is going to be facing the winner of a Republican runoff between, you've got basically two military veterans, Tony Gonzalez and Raul Reyes. And Raul Reyes is kind of a Tea Party Republican.
He's an immigration hardliner.
Absolutely.
And build that wall, throw everybody out. You know, he's a big Trumper.
And on the other hand, I think Tony Gonzalez has been has kind of taken a more moderate tone. I think he's pretty conservative, but I think he's kind of more nuanced and careful in the way he kind of talks about the issues.
I think he's trying to follow the model that was set by Will Hurd.
Right.
And he even got Will Hurd's endorsement.
He did.
And so when it comes to winning the party nomination, that can be a problem. That could be problematic, you know, because actually Will Hurd was not deeply loved by the people who are deep in the local Republican Party.
Yeah, Will Hurd had basically the right formula for a Republican to win a general election. I mean, I had been with him at polling sites on election day where, you know, Democrats would come up to him and thank him for various constituent services or just, you know, listening to concerns that they had.
And he also fired off an op-ed in the New York Times critical of Donald Trump's handling of issues like immigration and the border wall.
And so he kind of tried to thread this needle. A lot of Democrats thought, well, he talks, you know, he talks a good game, but ultimately he ends up voting with Republicans on a lot of issues.
Yeah, we see him in these hearings talking about securing our elections and Russian interference and asking very deep and pointed questions. That seemed to show that he had a very keen awareness of what was going on. Former CIA guy,
right.
Intelligence. I mean, he's a really smart guy, but then not following through with what you seem to be the logical conclusion of his line of questioning and voting in support, like of wrapping up the investigation into Russian interference, the congressional investigation, when when the Republicans were still in control.
Certainly, he voted with Republicans on the big tax cut of 2017, which was, you know, very controversial. So he was someone who was just Republican enough to be able to just able to seem reasonable enough to most Democrats or pragmatic enough to be able to just thread that needle. But in doing so, he faced criticism from some Republicans saying he's a Republican in name only. And so
when we say that he's really smart, really intelligent, he was smart enough to read the writing on the wall.
Yeah.
And he resigned from Congress. He declined to run for reelection.
Yeah. And I think that he's somebody, I mean, Will Hurd has gotten a lot of national attention because he is a very interesting figure because he's with a CIA background, his willingness to at least vocalize some criticisms of Trump, particularly on the border policy, while not necessarily always following through on votes. And, you know, he's a rare prominent African-American Republican. So a lot of people are following his career, but I think he's basically kind of waiting things out to see if the climate changes for the Republican Party. What's the post-Donald Trump Republican Party going to look like?
Well, there are people who are climate change deniers for the Republican Party, and they don't think anything's ever going to change. We're just because they're in too deep. But so with Raul Reyes, who from Castroville, and he's a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, he's this hardliner. And the question is, like, will if he becomes the nominee, because they got to get through this runoff, Will that be too much for the general election? And Gina Ortiz Jones, who's been at this a little bit longer, this is her second go around in this race, did really well, 1,000 votes short. Mm-hmm. You know, now she's hoping Medina County will come around for her this time. This will be easier for her to win.
Right. And I think that no matter who wins that Republican runoff, Gina Ortiz Jones is in a commanding position in that district. And I think Republicans will privately tell you this is going to be a really tough race for any Republican to win in 2020. But because Donald Trump is not the most popular figure in that district, as you said, it covers a lot of border area, and his policies, including the push to build a border wall, and some of his rhetoric about undocumented immigrants, he's not the most popular figure in that district. You know, Hillary Clinton actually won District 23 in 2016, and it's a testament to Will Hurd that he was able to somehow pull off a victory in that election and outperform Donald Trump.
It could be a testament to Will Hurd, or it could be like Pete Gallego. What are you doing? You know,
that's another part of that story.
Quit putting your kid in your commercials and make a case for you running for office. Now let's go to the Senate race. You know, in the Democratic side,
right?
It looks like we're in a runoff here. Yeah. MJ Hager is the number one slot. It's a battle over who's going to be in number two.
Right. And as we're speaking, I think it's a very close race for number two between Cristina Zinzun Ramirez, a progressive activist. She was a Bernie Sanders supporter in 2016. She has, I think she was still a college student in Austin, formed a labor advocacy group. She started a voter engagement group called Jolt in recent years.
She's very engaging and very charismatic.
Very much so. And she's somebody who's gotten a lot of progressives outside of the state interested. Alec Baldwin, the actor, is a big fan of hers and has sort of encouraged people to contribute to her campaign. And
taking another break, this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me in the studio, Gilbert Garcia, San Antonio Express News columnist, looking at the results from last night's Super Tuesday. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. With me in the studio, Gilbert Garcia, San Antonio Express News columnist, and we're looking at last night's Super Tuesday returns. So we did have primary yesterday, statewide in Texas and across all these other states for Super Tuesday. Former Vice President Joe Biden apparently has the Joe-mentum coming out of Super Tuesday. Bernie Sanders, of course, we all know him as a never-say-die individual, and he's going to keep going and try to reclaim the front runner status. It's interesting how Texas went. Started out looking strong for Bernie Sanders, but as the night went along, and we're able to get more ballots from away from the strong urban core areas that it shaped up for Joe Biden.
In looking at the presidential race and the way Bernie Sanders was sort of depicted as the front runner. And then all of a sudden we were hearing after South Carolina that now Joe Biden is, he's got all this momentum going. And I found myself questioning, well, is it, how much of this is really just a shift in voter attitudes, and how much of it is just that the primary schedule started to get more conducive to Joe Biden? He has, I think, more support among African-American Democrats than other candidates. And the map started to get better for him. So I found myself wondering, is this kind of a media construct that now all of a sudden he's got this momentum and things have really turned around? But I think that there is strong evidence in Texas and possibly in other states that was the case, because Bernie Sanders was winning Texas by a pretty good margin in the early voting. And Joe Biden was able to carry the state on the strength of the election day results. And that's basically because 3 days before he had won South Carolina, and one day before he got the endorsements of Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, and Beto O'Rourke. And so I think that you really did see within the state of Texas that Democrats were changing their opinions. And one of the anecdotal things we heard in San Antonio was that there were voters going to some polling sites who were asking if they could vote again or they could change their votes. And right. unfortunately, they weren't able to, but they were thinking,
because
you know,
they voted early
that's right.
for either Mayor Pete or for Amy Klobuchar and Senator Klobuchar. And then they dropped out and right. they say, well, you know, what about my early vote?
Yeah.
And so that's not good if people can't vote early because they don't know if anyone's going to drop out. Some people said, I'll never vote early again.
Yeah.
And then we have these long lines on election day.
Yeah. I mean, because, you know, you actually think you would want to encourage people to early vote because the process tends to go more smoothly and it's more convenient for people generally. But that was a problem here. You had candidates dropping out just before Super Tuesday. And I think that one of the things that you saw with Joe Biden's big win in South Carolina was that it not only, convinced Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg that there was no path forward for them. They had struggled in particular to win over African-American voters, and this was a big test, and they failed that test. So it not only basically pushed them out of the race, but it also made them decide to immediately endorse Joe Biden. And I don't know that they would have done it if they had not had some belief that Biden was viable, because a week before that, people are thinking this his campaign's collapsing. And so I think that South Carolina not only made him viable and someone that people were willing to endorse, but it also narrowed the field.
So with Joe Biden, out of the gate, he seemed like the front runner. And then people kind of fell out of love with him as right. he campaigned. The more he campaigned, the more people were saying, well, I don't know about this guy.
Right.
And they started flirting around with some of these other candidates, whether it be Mayor Pete, even Bloomberg got a hard look by a lot of people. I mean, they, you know, $300 million will buy you a hard look. Yeah. And then he went on the debate stage and, you know, his pants fell down. You know, he basically pantsed himself on national television in that debate. And it didn't. And so people say, well, I guess let's go back to Joe Biden.
Yeah. And I think really a lot of Democrats, I think, are looking at their options. If you're a moderate Democrat, or if you're just, even if you consider yourself progressive, but you're not willing to go all in with Bernie Sanders, that Joe Biden is clearly became the most viable option. And I think there are Democrats who wonder, you know, he has a propensity for gaffes. They wonder about how strong he would be in a general election against Donald Trump. But I think that many Democrats, when they had to make the decision and they looked at the field as it was basically, if you're a moderate Democrat, you were basically looking at Joe Biden or Mayor Bloomberg. And I think that choice became pretty clear.
Okay, so we still don't know who's going to end up with the nomination and then what's going to happen move forward. But the question is, the Bernie Sanders, the Bernie bros, are they going to get on the Biden bus? And are they just going to be butthurt and refuse to play along? And we know that Sanders will say some of the right things, mm-hmm. but will he actually campaign and be full-throated in support of the nominee? When they were on the stage at one of the debates and they said, who yeah. raised your hand, or what do you think? Are you going to go along with the convention rules?
Right.
And Bernie says, I think we should let the majority do it, you know, and so what happens with the majority is going to go for Biden. Are you going to go
yeah.
with him?
Well, I think the question was, do you think that whoever gets the plurality of delegates, even if they haven't reach that threshold of reaching a majority of pledged delegates, if someone has a plurality going into the convention, should everybody kind of coalesce behind that candidate? And he said yes, and because he figured that was going to be him, and of course the others said no. And
yeah, so that could be the most played soundbite in the next 2 weeks.
It could cut the other way, absolutely. And so, you know, I really think a lot of his supporters are going to be unwilling to support Biden, and they're going to be very resentful about this. And it, you know, ultimately, look, if Biden wins the primaries, you the fault, if you're a Bernie Sanders supporter, ultimately you'd have to put the fault with the voters. You can't. It's not like the old days when the party bosses are controlling things. But I think where the Bernie Sanders people would complain is they would say, oh, all these endorsements started coming along, and that it was kind of orchestrated in some way.
Right. All right. So we'll have to see how things play out. We'll hopefully we'll maintain faith in the democratic process and elections move forward smoothly. And I want to thank Gilbert Garcia for your insight. It's Express News columnist. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.